Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Join us live in New York City on June 20th, 2018 for Entree Architect Live, an interactive small group workshop designed exclusively for you, the small firm entrepreneur architect. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/New York. You are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 217. Welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, you're in the process of launching a startup, or you may be an experienced small firm architect just like me, just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. It's been 215 episodes, but he's back. Today we have Bob Borson, and we talk about his firm, his family, and life of an architect. Join us. We'll be right back after these messages. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM, specifications, and much more at rcat.com, and FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work that you love. Bob Borson, welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. I am excited after such an extended delay to be back on my favorite podcast.
Yeah, number two. Yeah. Number one was like an experiment, so I really call you number one.
Well, I'm glad somebody does. I'll take it.
So anybody wants to hear the first episode, that was before you moved and became a partner in your current firm. So that's how long ago that was.
Yeah, that would make it, yeah. That would make it at least 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, it was 2012. Early 2013.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Yeah. It's a long time. Congratulations on your lengthy and successful run in podcasting.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you being here. I think probably the majority of our listeners know who you are, but let me just give them a brief intro here, and then we'll get into some interesting conversation here. Bob Borson is a principal of Malone Maxwell Borson Architects, a full service architecture firm based in Dallas, Texas. The award-winning practice is frequently published and is widely recognized for its thoughtful and considered designs. In 2013, Malone Maxwell Borson Architects was honored as the AIA Dallas Firm of the Year. So that's pretty cool. Bob is very active at his local and state components of the American Institute of Architects, where he serves on several committees, led several initiatives, very focused and determined on at local AIA, sort of local and state chapters over there. And in 2009, Bob was recognized by the Dallas AIA as Young Architect of the Year. And in 2017, he was elevated into the AIA National College of Fellows. So he is an FAIA. Most of our listeners probably know Bob through his blog that he writes and maintains at lifeofanarchitect.com, which is currently the most visited privately maintained architectural blog site in the world, which is pretty awesome. Millions of listeners every year. He's also a very dedicated dad and mom, or he's not a mom. He's a very dedicated husband and dad, and a traveler. And he has great tips. A great tip that Bob has given me over the years. We always bump into each other at AIA conferences and national convention. And he's always saying, sign up for the tours, take the tours. And so I think that's very good advice for everybody. And that's sort of, I want to get into family and travel. That's what I want to talk to you about, because you just came back from Ireland. And so I want to hear a little bit about that. But I really want to talk about, you know, how that all works with the firm. How does the firm and the family sort of integrate with one another? That's what I want to get into. But before we do that, I want you to go back, tell your origin story. Where did you discover architecture? What inspired you to become an architect? And tell us that story from that point to where you are today.
How long do we have? That's a long story.
Half hour. You got about 30 seconds. Go.
All right, there you go. Well, here's the short version. So my earliest recollection was that I wanted to be an architect. And I didn't even know that architecture was a job. I didn't know what the title of it was. I just thought this seemed like a cool thing. And my dad, who was an engineer, surprisingly encouraged it. And when I was 5 years old, as a present, I got a drafting board, a T-square, and a triangle. And I didn't know what any of them were, right? They're just these things, but it was like such a really beautiful piece of wood. I remember with absolute clarity that I looked at this board and I ran my hands over it and I thought, I'm going to cut this up and make a boat. Yeah. Right? I don't know why it was a boat, but that's what I was going to do. And my dad was like, no, it's a drawing board. And so he started showing me how to use it. And it just kind of went from there. And I don't know if that kind of locked me into this trajectory that this is what I was, and I just never wavered from it. But it was just, you know, the funny thing about it was just at that moment it was cemented, this is what I'm gonna do with my life.
How old were you?
I was 5 years old.
Five. So that's probably the earliest that I've ever had anybody.
It was the earliest. And really there was no logic. There was no like, I think it was this beautiful piece of wood that really did it. And the other thing that helped is I met a guy. Well, you know, when I was a young teenage boy, I mean, I might not even have been a teenager yet. You know, maybe I was 10, 11, 12, 13, somewhere in that range. A guy that I knew had bought a Porsche 928. And I thought that was the coolest car I'd ever seen in my life. And I'm not a huge car guy, but at that moment, you know, I guess 13-year-old boys are all into cars a little bit. Yep. And he was an architect. And I thought, that's just really, I'm on the right track.
Locked it in.
Yeah, what I didn't realize is that was like a really old Porsche that he had. I think it was like falling apart, and it wasn't as cool as I remember it when I visited him in the years since then. But yeah, that's pretty much the origin story. I get so many contacts from younger people that are wondering if this is the right path for them and are they going to be good at it, and they want to hear that origin story. I tell them that I went to college, and I'd always thought this is what I want to be. In my freshman year in architecture school, I sucked. I mean, I was terrible. And a lot of it had to do with my maturity level. I was really immature and I didn't put really the time and attention and effort into doing what I needed to do based on where I was going to school and the just unbelievable alpha talent that was surrounding me. And I had this huge identity crisis that all of a sudden I'm 18 years old. And this thing that literally I thought this is what I want to do with my life since I was 5 years old, I thought, and you suck at it. You're terrible. And it's like, now what do I do?
Yeah.
Luckily, I got through it and just kind of refocused my efforts, and things have kind of fallen into place since then. But that's essentially the story.
What got you through that? Do you know why you kept moving forward?
Well, you know, it's hard to give up on I don't even know if I'd call it a dream. It was such a certainty, right?
This destiny is
what it was going to be. Yeah. And for all of a sudden to think that was not true was literally at 18 years old was impossible for me to digest.
Yeah.
So I actually took a year off from design school. I mean, I was still at college and I was still taking all the other classes. I just didn't take studio.
Yeah.
And the truth is I grew up during that 1 year. You know, I became a little bit more mature. I kind of, you know, my parents were really kind of buttoned down folks. And when I went to college, I kind of went a little crazy. I mean, I had a lot of fun that first year. And I think that was really kind of what created this identity crisis, because I wasn't spending the time or effort and energy focusing on the things I needed to. I was too busy having a good time. And then that kind of got out of my system. And then when I kind of really got back into it, my third year in college, which is part of the reason it took me 6 years to get out of architecture school, my 5-year degree, I just didn't have any problems anymore.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think that happens to a lot of us who decide early on. I decided when I was 10, I wanted to be an artist. Mom said, artists don't make any money. She said, architects make money. And so, okay, architects make money. I'll be an architect. So 10 years old, I locked it in, put the blinders on, didn't let anything else, you know, sway me from becoming an architect, even sort of manipulated the career, you know, tests that you take in middle school to make sure that it results in architecture.
See, that's problem solving at an early age.
Exactly. Yeah. And I had the same problem when you get into architecture school and it was the only thing that you've ever considered. And you realize, well, this is harder than you thought, and it's not as easy, and you're not as good as you thought you were going to be, and you start questioning whether it's the right thing to do. And I went through that same crisis, thought I'd quit and go, you know, detail cars, because I was doing that in the summer, making lots of money, start a business.
And the truth is, it's kind of an all-in education. I mean, when you start it, you don't kind of ease into it. I mean, it is cannonball into the deep end.
Yeah.
So.
And first year, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm not surprised that people, when they first go to school and they start this process, are kind of, you know, get a little shocked to the system about what's actually happening. And they start questioning, oh my God, did I make the right decision?
Yeah. And I think the culture of architecture school, it's intended to do that. It's intended to weed out the weak, right? The ones that aren't really serious about it. They want those people to drop. So, you know, the cream rises to the crop and continues on. You know, our architecture school at Roger Williams originally, now there's a big addition on it, but originally it was designed that the first year was really big, and then it was designed in this stepping pattern that as you got down in studios, the studio got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, showing you right from day one in the architecture that when you're a freshman, you know, a third of you are going to make it, you know, and that's what happens.
Yeah, I know. I know you want to move on, but I told my daughter, I go, this actually happens in a lot of professions, but you know, some of it has to do with, like, I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and their weed out process really is just getting into the program. So you look around, and you know, my graduating class, this is kind of salient point here, is, you know, the University of Texas has 50 some odd thousand enrolled students. My graduating class had like 27 people in it. Right. I mean, very, very small. Yeah. But the difference between where I started and where I ended up, you know, we only lost a half dozen people. You know, they're like, we vetted out the people just by making it so hard to get in, as opposed to other schools that say, hey, give us, if you're interested, let's let you stick your toe in the water. And then they literally kill you to separate the wheat and the chaff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I don't know which schools follow which practice, but I definitely know that all the people I went in, they all showed up with their game faces, and I got in like through a back door, I think. But
they saw your future. They knew what you were destined for. They couldn't let that one go by.
Yeah. Well,
so
kudos for them.
What did when you had that crisis and you sort of weren't sure about what you wanted to do, and you always wanted to be an architect? I'm assuming that your mom and dad also knew that you wanted to be an architect. How did they feel when you said, well, maybe this isn't me? What did they do?
They didn't do anything, because I never told them that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my mom wanted me to be a musician, to be honest with you. And I think that I wouldn't say she was disappointed that I didn't go that route, because I know that she was proud of me for what I've accomplished. But there was a little bit of this, you know, this is who I see my child as. And if they didn't really see me struggling, what they saw me was goofing off, right? It wasn't a matter of, you can't do this. It was, and actually I have two older sisters, and they're not older by much. We're separated by 3 years and 2 weeks, top to bottom, right? I mean, it was like 18 months, you know, 18 months.
Right.
So the sister who's just one up from me, who's 18 months older than me, she pulled me aside once and she said, Mom and Dad are going to pull you out of school if you don't get your act together. Right. And I was like, what? Like, I mean, I wasn't making like F's. I was still making good grades, but they could tell that I wasn't dialed in the way that I needed to be for me to find the success that would be required to enjoy this as a path to have taken. And that was a pretty sobering kind of, you know, the reality of it. Like, I imagine the equivalent is, if you're 5 years old, is if you do that, we're going to give you a spanking, right? And you're motivated by spankings hurt, right? I don't want that.
Do you think that was part of what helped you mature that year? That sort of your sister saying, hey, if you don't shape up, you know, they're going to pull you out.
Yeah, no question. Because, you know, the message being delivered via my sister had a little bit different kind of sting to it than if it came from my parents. You know, because she didn't really futz around with it. She just kind of said, blah, there it is. I mean, it was like a slap in the face. You know, there was no easing into it. There's like, hey, we understand you're going through some things. You know, it was just like, get your crap together or you're done.
Yeah.
And that was my sister. Like, you know, it was crazy.
Yeah.
She denies having said it. She goes, everyone goes, we don't remember that happening. And I'm like, that was a watershed moment in my college career. So
it saved absolutely your career as an architect.
That's right. I have her to blame. Yeah,
exactly. And we all have it to blame too. We have to listen to you and read you. And so I thank your sister for saving you, because you've contributed much to the profession.
I'll pass it along. I'm sure she'll be heartfelt to receive it.
So. I'm sure. Big sister. So the reason I wanted to ask about your mom and dad, because, you know, now you're in that position, right? Kate, your daughter, how old is Kate?
She's 13 years old. She'll be 14 in a couple months.
Yeah. So she's like she's my middle one. My middle one is 13. Yeah. And my oldest is actually in the process of looking for colleges, has decided he doesn't want to go to college. And so
that's okay.
I know there's that side too. And I'm okay with that too. But there are other pressures from other people. that makes it important. Actually, UT is one of the schools that he's interested in. He wants to go for business. And so we may actually take a ride down there.
It's a good business school.
Yeah. And so, but you know, that now we're in that position as parents, right? And we're trying to run architecture firms and we're trying to be good dads. And I think that's hard sometimes. I think it's hard to sort of integrate the firm and your family. You want your firm to be as successful as it can be, both financially and, you know, from a design point of view. And that takes a lot of effort and time to do that. And so it's sometimes the family sacrifices you sacrifice your family to get to that certain point. And sometimes it's the other way around.
Sure.
So how do you deal with that? Because, you know, your firm's very successful. You spend a lot of time on the other things that you do as well with the blog and the writing that you do. And so how do you sort of mesh those two? How do you keep your firm and your family both, you know, where they need to be?
Well, you know, for what it's worth, and I'm not making light of this for other people's challenges or difficulties, is I just don't find it very hard to do. In our office, you know, we're not very big. I think we currently have 7 people here in the office, and we have, or at least we try to have, a culture that you're a better architect if you have interests outside of the office. Right. So we're not motivated by you showing up at the crack of dawn and going home just before the crack of dawn every single day. And the truth is we actually encourage people to get out. We've even shaped the hours in our office. You know, we close the office on Fridays at noon just so that it gives people an opportunity to take care of stuff that they need to during the day, or if they want to get a jump start on their weekend and take a trip somewhere. You know, it's hard to take a little weekend excursion when you have to start after work on a Friday night, you know? So if you shut down you have everybody work till our hours are 8 to 6 Monday through Thursday, and then 8 to noon on Fridays. And I'd bet more times than not, somebody in the office is going somewhere every single weekend, you know, and they are able to get a jump start at 1 o'clock on a Friday and move from there. And it's something that we do. It's something we encourage. You know, one of the other partners, Michael, he has 4 kids. He has 2 that are out of college, and he has 1 that just is in their freshman year of college, and 1 that's, I think, a junior in high school. And he's very motivated. His family's a big motivator for him. And, you know, one of the benefits of working for a firm like ours, or at the very least having your name on the door, is if you need to be gone on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go watch a soccer game, then go do it. You know, we have the mentality, you're still a grown up. You still have to do your work. You still have a task that you have to complete. Nobody does your job when you're not here. But it doesn't necessarily mean as long as you've handled what needs to be handled from a client request, or, you know, you have a meeting, you know, you either don't schedule a meeting when you want to be at the soccer game, or you'd miss the soccer game if you can't avoid it. But we don't let that stuff get in the way. You know, everyone can solve that problem if they want to.
So it's culture. Your firm, yeah, your firm has, it's whether it's intentional or it's sort of evolutionary from, you know, just from the way that your priorities and Michael's priorities, that the culture has been established, that's the way it is set up. How intentional was that at the beginning, and how intentional is it now?
I think it's always kind of been in place. You know, of course, Michael's had his name on the door for like 25 years. And while I was actually his first employee back in 1992, you know, I've left the firm and come back. This is actually my 3rd time in the office when he asked me to come back and join him as a partner and kind of reshape how the firm was going to operate. But he's always kind of operated in that capacity because it's always been something for him. Now that I'm not an employee, as it were, that same latitude's extended to me. And it's really hard to, you know, lead from the ivory tower and make a different set of rules for yourself than you would allow to everyone else in the office. So we don't, at least I don't do that. We just ask people to, like, give us a heads up if you need to go do something, be somewhere else. And if there's a problem, we'll deal with it. But no one ever says no. You know, if you say, hey, can I leave early to go do this? Or there's a lecture I want to hear and I need to leave it for. Fine, great, go do it.
Yeah.
We still have the expectation. Now, one of the things that's different is, you know, my responsibilities with the office require me to sit in front of a computer a lot, talk on the phone a lot. But it's not something that I can't do at 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night or whatever. So half the time I come home, I participate in my family. And then as my daughter's doing her homework, I'm doing my work. But I'm not isolated off somewhere else in another part of the city, you know, doing it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I talk about the integrated life rather than work-life balance, you know, that's a perfect example of that. Sometimes, you know, your family and your firm overlap, but it's intentional that you're not sacrificing one for the other. You're actually making them work together, that there's sometimes where you're working and sometimes you're focused on your family, but sometimes they happen throughout the day at different times. Like, You may go to soccer in the middle of the day, but then you're back at work to do what you need to do at work, and they sort of just all mesh and you know, meld together.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's the idea, and this rationalization, or at least this realization, maybe a better way to put it, comes across every entrepreneur, architect, every small firm architect, every guy, person, woman, whomever, working for themselves in a small office. The light bulb goes off that the more I work, the more money I make, right? It's fairly binary. And you have to make a decision at some point that says the balance is not between home life and work life. It's to me, it's kind of money driven. And if I wanted to work 60 hours a week, I'd make more money. But the truth is I don't want to work that much. And it's the extra money. I do all right. I do well enough to be able to live the life that brings me happiness. And I'm not willing to sacrifice what I have for some, you know, to make it a disproportionate, you know, I don't need 3 houses. I don't drive a fancy car because I don't really care. Those things are not what motivate me. So it's easy for me to sit up on my perch here and say, oh, it's a piece of cake. You know, I don't work because I don't want to work. And there are people out there that are working hard because they need to work hard because they have different, you know, my wife works, we have 1 child, you know, we're dual income family. I'm not the sole provider in my family. So the burden to cover our expenses and do what needs to be done does not just rest on my shoulders. And that provides me a certain amount of, flexibility and this attitude that I am so cavalierly throwing out to the people who are listening to this episode. Now, my wife does well. I do well. We can't complain, and it's a place you put yourself in mentally. And I know that if I wanted to live in a nicer house, or if I wanted to have a bigger lot, or if I wanted to have a weekend place, or if I wanted a boat, these are the things that motivated me. I know what I would need to do to make it happen. Truth is, I'm not motivated by those things. So I can do what I want to do.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, and FreshBooks. For years, when I needed information on manufacturers' products, I headed straight to the internet, straight to google.com. And then I sifted through the hundreds of results, maybe thousands of results, to find the one or two that might be the link that I'm looking for. And more often than not, it wasn't. It wasn't what I was looking for, or it was outdated, or it didn't meet my requirements. So what do? I go back to the search engine and I start all over again. And this could take all afternoon to find the one or two or three products that I'm looking for. Does this sound familiar? Do you do this? There is a better way. Our friends at RCAT. RCAT.com, A-R-C-A-T. Find what you're looking for in seconds. Building, product information, BIM, CAD, custom specifications using their exclusive tool, SpecWizard, and keep it all online right there in one place using their cloud-based project organization tool, Charette. Here's an idea. Make RCAT a part of your efficient project workflow. Use it on every project. Just type in entrearchitect.com/RCAT. That's entrearchitect.com/RCAT. Type that into your internet browser and add it to your favorites. And then on every project, use RCAT. Just click that link. You'll go straight to RCAT and you'll find everything that you're looking for in seconds. Find what you need fast and make more money on every project. EntreeArchitect.com/RCAT. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. And getting started with FreshBooks, this is so ridiculously easy. Most people send their first invoice seconds after starting their free trial. It's a click of a button. The same goes for tracking time, managing expenses, collaborating with contractors, and viewing financial reports. It's simple, fast, easy, life-changing. And if you need help at any time, free award-winning customer service is a phone call or an email away. I've used it. It works. And if you ever have second thoughts, don't worry. On top of their free trial for Entree Architect listeners, you get a free 30-day money-back guarantee, so you don't ever have to worry about choosing FreshBooks. So give it a try. It's free for 30 days. Just visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and then let them know that we sent you by sharing Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks to access your free unlimited 30-day trial. So RCAT and FreshBooks, please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. It comes down to choices, right? You've chosen to sacrifice some of those things that you might have, you know, a lake house or a boat or a fancy car, to be able to have a life that you can spend more time with your daughter and your wife when you want to, and go away on vacation for a week because that's a priority and that's what you want to do. You know, it's all about choices. If you want to make $1 million a year, you can do that, but there's going to be a lot of sacrifices and choices you need to make to make that happen.
That's right. And the truth this isn't even just a conversation about family life and work life. This is a conversation that could structure what type of architect you are, and the type of market sector you might want to work in. The truth is, this actually goes back to one of the very first blog posts that I wrote, that kind of put my site on the map. And, you know, I wrote two posts on consecutive days. One was top 10 reasons to be an architect, and one was top 10 reasons not to be an architect. And I did this in response to an article that I'd read from an architect who in the digital world, we all know who this guy is. I've never said who it was, but if I told you, you would know who it is. Yeah. I like this guy, a lot of respect for him. I think he's a clever, incredibly bright, clever person. But he talked about architects don't get enough, don't get paid enough. The work we do is hard and it's challenging and we're not, you know, respected. Yes. And I hear that argument so much, it just makes me want to shove a pencil in my eye. And and part of it is really driven by my gut reactions. Well, maybe you're just not that good. And I'm not, that's really a demeaning thing to kind of throw out because, I mean, I don't know what kind of architect he is. I don't know about his skill level, but I don't buy that argument. And I know that if you as an architect want to make a lot of money, there are decisions you can make where your career is concerned that will put you on a, if you want to do tilt wall warehouse buildings that are 200,000 square feet, you'll probably be able to do a lot more and make more money than if you choose to do the labor intensive communication, you know, crazy levels of doing high-end residential work. You know, the amount of work that we put in per dollar is way different than if someone says, I need a warehouse and their input is, it needs to be this big, right? And you just kind of roll them out, or you do site adapts for circuit cities or something, which someone needs to do that. There's quality and there's ability to do that. And it's a need, you know, and the fee scale is going to be different than the kind of work that I take on. And so you as a person, not necessarily you, Mark, but as an architect, there's lots of decisions that you have to make in your career that are going to shape how you live your life. Some of it's financial related. Some of it's how you spend your time. But they're all interlinked with one another.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I always push planning so much that for young architects, if you want to be at a certain place at a certain time in your life, you need to be intentional about that. You need to make the choices to get to those places and make the decisions that will move you in that direction.
Perfect.
Because otherwise you'll end up, you know, where you don't want to be, you know, you know, if you want to do high-end residential architecture, there's a path for that. And if you want to make a lot of money, there's a path for that.
And sometimes they all come together. Yeah, I mean, certainly there are people that do well and people that don't do well in all these different market sectors. I think that the trick when I talk to younger people a lot of times is the skill is figuring out what your skill set is, because there's a difference, especially true in younger people, of knowing what they want to do versus what they're good at. And sometimes those don't align. Like, I want to be a great designer, but I'm not, and they're not willing to concede that yet. And so this vision they have for themselves, for the path that they want to take, isn't going to fall into place. And I went through something in my own career. I'm actually pretty good at talking with folks, and I think I'm a pretty good designer. And I kept for long, like, I didn't even take the license exam until I was 30 years old. And part of the reason I did it because I felt I didn't know enough to be able to pass that exam. I mean, I didn't know how to be an architect yet, because every job I took, I said, I need to learn how to do construction drawings. And they would start. And then before too long, they'd say, we got someone else who can do that. We're going to put you in the room with the client. And so my skill set was my ability to communicate, and, you know, I'm pretty good at not putting my foot in my mouth too deeply. And I would end up changing jobs because I'd say, this is not what I want to do. I need to learn how to do this stuff or I'm never going to be an architect. And it wasn't until I probably reached my mid-30s that the light bulb went off and said, okay, this is what I'm good at and I need to embrace it.
Yeah. Follow your strengths. The sooner you discover your strength, and that's why tests like strength builders and things like that are so valuable, because you can discover the things that make you tick, the things that you love to do and why you love to do them. Usually the things you love to do are because you're good at them, and the things that you struggle with tend to be the things that you don't like. I, you know, as an architect, I always wanted to design and be the designer, but I very early learned that the business is what got me excited about it. I married an architect who was very good at the design end of things. And so I let her do all the design and I do all the business, and we love our life. And I don't design at all anymore, ever, you know? And so, I'm happy for that, because that's not where my passion is. It's not what I love to do.
Sure.
And so those are all about being intentional and making choices and planning. And you had talked about how the culture is so important to the way you live your life and the way your firm lives your life. That also allows you to sort of do things like you just came back from Ireland. Talk about that a little bit and how those trips that you take, because I know I follow you on Instagram and follow you on Twitter, and I see that you occasionally go away and you'll go to these fun places that are unique and adventurous. And so talk about how that works into your family and the firm and how you make those things happen.
Well, I get a decent amount of time off, you know, and my daughter, her age and where she gets breaks. And so like the trip to Ireland was during her spring break.
Yep.
And my wife gets a similar amount of time off. And so we tend to try to take advantage of the time off that we were provided by the stations we've achieved in our respective careers. I didn't do a lot of traveling as a child. You know, my parents were somewhat grounded a little bit. And if it didn't involve getting in a car and driving to Minnesota for 3 days, we generally didn't do it.
Yeah.
And, it was something that I always kind of felt like I had lacked, right? It was something that I missed out on. And when I was in college, I did a study abroad program, and it was not based in a single city. So for the fall semester, a little tail end of summer, the fall semester, and kind of the holiday Christmas break beginning of January, I was in Europe. And I got back from that trip and I realized I'd been in more foreign countries than I'd been in states. And it wasn't something that I go, you know, and I learned a lot about myself when I was on the trip. I was at an age to where I saw lots of buildings, but there was no context to it. It was just like, look at that detail, look at that building, look at the big stones on the bottom and the smaller stones on the top. You know, the context was a little bit different. And I realized that as I started to get older, and I was very fortunate, the job that my wife had when we first got married, she had the very, you know, generic title of consultant. And part of her job entailed her traveling to a client site every single week. And so she would fly out on a Monday and fly back on a Thursday. And so she was just racking up car rental points and hotel points and status and frequent flyer miles like crazy. And we had no money. I mean, we had no money when I was younger, but we had all this miles and hotel vouchers and all this kind of stuff. So it allowed us to take all sorts of trips when we were in our 20s that we never would have been able to afford otherwise. Like we would go to London for a 3-day weekend just because we could, it was easy. Now, the funny thing that was about it is we'd get to these places and we'd stay in these amazing hotels and you know, we couldn't eat there and we couldn't drink, have a drink. Yeah. We didn't have any money, right? So, and we walk into the lobby in our tennis shoes and our jeans and we're looking at these people that, you know, have their drivers out front waiting to pick them up, you know, and they're wearing suits and we look like we should have gone in through the delivery entrance around the side. But it was fun and we had a great time with it. And we went to all different sorts of countries. And it was something that when we had our daughter, we thought it's important for us to expose to her that how we live is not how it is everywhere, that there are different people, different cultures, and everyone doesn't look like us and people don't eat the same food that we eat. And cause it was something I didn't have growing up as a child.
Yeah.
And, so like this trip to Ireland is actually the second time I've been there. My wife lived there for a while. My wife was actually born in England. She's not English. You know, she doesn't have an accent. There's nothing, you know, yep, cool like that. But she lived in Ireland for a period of time when she was in like middle school, like when she was like 12, 13 years old. So 14 years ago, we decided, let's go to Ireland. Let's just kind of see where you spent part of your life. And it was a beautiful country and had a lot of fun. It was really kind of casual and peaceful. There's not a lot of cutting edge architecture that's necessarily happening over there. But there's a lot of history and the country is just ridiculously pretty.
Yeah.
And the people are off the charts nice and friendly. We had a blast. And so my daughter started getting to the age where who she is and where she came from and what her background is and what her heritage and what grandpa was, what's he, and you know, and she learns that, you know, she's half Norwegian and a quarter American Indian and, you know, part Irish and part English and all this kind of stuff. So she ended up doing a school project and it led her to think that she wanted to go see Ireland. So we asked her, where do you want to go for spring break this year? And she goes, I want to go to Ireland. So, I mean, that's how we chose that as a destination. And the thing about it, you and I kind of chatted offline a little bit about this, that the way these vacations get put together is my wife does it. She literally does every bit of the work. I do none of it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, if I was being brutally honest, it's because I'm lazy. But the truth
is, it's not your strength, Bob. That's
you know. Well, I, you know, the
your,
truth
your
is,
your strength is to show up.
My, you know, yeah, I'm excellent at showing up, and so, so what? My wife is a, is our brains work differently. You know, she got her advanced degrees in math, and she's a very linear thinker. So the idea that there's like schedules and agendas, and we show up here, and we're going to drive to this point, we're going to go here for this long, and then we're going to go. That makes just that sentence almost made my head explode on this recording. So I'm more of a drop me in some place and then I'm going to spin around and go, what's that? And walk over to it. That's kind of how, and that doesn't, it's not really good strategy for vacation planning. And so I let my wife take care of it and she'll come and she'll say, what do you think about this? And I'll chime in with my opinion. And so I might kind of, I have a small rudder in the process that kind of guides us from A to B at times, but for the most part, my wife says, hey, we're going to fly in at this time in this location, and then here are the places we're going to ping pong along the way. What's your pecking order of activities that you might want to see out of these things? And I show up and I have a great time. And the truth is you know, my daughter, until just very recently, has always said that she wanted to be an architect. And she's still kind of thinking maybe that might be something interested in doing, but for some reason becoming a dermatologist has shown up on the scene here recently. And so going on these tours and going and looking at buildings was not something I had to like drag them both kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
But they have a threshold, right? Nobody wants to go on architectural trips in my family, maybe other than me. And even me, I don't care so much because I'm on holiday and I like looking at stuff, but I'm more interested in like turning parts of my brain off so that I can enjoy my time with my family. So on all these trips, especially and particularly the one we just got back from, I may have done 3% of the work involved. My job was driving the car on the left-hand side of the road and not crashing into any walls. That was my job.
And taking selfies.
Well, I have longer arms than anybody else. So
yeah. I saw the daily selfie. Everybody should go to Bob Borson on Instagram and go check out all the pictures from Ireland. Beautiful.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm not a selfie person. I'm not very photogenic.
Yeah, it's the only time I've ever seen you. Shoot
I know. Selfies. I just, you know, I just assume people not know what I look like. But the thing that I think is kind of funny is it's really windy. You know, it's not super cold there right now, but it's. Interestingly enough, the weather is almost identical to what it is here in Dallas, Texas. I mean, like the lows were in the. You know, the upper 30s and the highs were in the low 50s, and it's not bad, right?
Yeah.
But you go to some of these places and there's like an 80 mile an hour wind blowing everywhere. And, you know, I'll tell you, while 45 might not be that cold, put an 80 mile an hour wind on it and it starts feeling a little chilly.
Yeah.
And so the whole selfie thing started because we were trying to take, like, we want a picture of our family just for our own purposes. To have, and I'm trying to take a picture, and my wife and daughter's hair is blowing around like crazy, and we look ridiculous. And I was like, "All right, we need to do one of these every day." And so that's kind of how that process started. It's the first time in 25 years of marriage that my wife and I are like, "Let's take a selfie."
Yeah, I loved it. I loved sort of. I loved that they were selfies, that they weren't just pictures of the scenery. That you could see the fun that you were having in each one of those pictures. You were all smiling and laughing, and the hair was going on everywhere. And you have your new beard, and you had your black glasses on. It looked like you were in Ireland incognito, so nobody would see.
I know.
It was,
I know.
I like the beard, by the way. I know people can't see it on the podcast, but they should go to the Instagram and go check it out. I like it.
All right. Yeah.
Is it permanent? Is it gonna stay?
You know what? I'm surprised. My wife is not a fan of facial hair. But I think as I have, you know, I'll be turning 50 here in a couple of weeks. And I think what happens is it makes me look thinner. I think that's her. She looks at it and she goes, hey, you look good. And I go, yeah, because you can't see how soft my throat is becoming. Now she looks, she goes, that's not true. But, you know, you can almost see her winking, you know, as she says it. But I don't know. We'll see what happens. You know, when it gets to be 100 degrees here, you know, I might reevaluate it, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well,
I like the not shaving part. I'll tell you that. That's awesome.
Yeah,
I love that.
It is convenient. I tried it for a little while and I just couldn't handle it. And my wife also wasn't a big fan, so it had to go. But I know that a lot of the architect community, they're all, you know, there's a whole contingent of bearders out there that just like their beards. And so.
Yeah,
I wouldn't join the club.
Well, no, I'll tell you, I wouldn't put myself in that category. And every now and then people take pictures and they'll say like beard, it'll be a close up. And I was like, nobody wants to see your beard that close. Nobody, including me. And the problem I run into is, you know, so I'm half Norwegian, which means I'm 100% Viking.
Yep.
And so I can grow this beard in like 45 minutes.
It's like,
it's just there. The problem is it's white, so you can't see it. I mean, I should say it's like clear, like that, like my hair is. It's like
transparent beard.
Yeah. And so it's like, I'd come into the office and people say, oh, you got a little something going there. And I go, what do you mean? It's like an inch long now. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah.
Well, it looks good. So people should definitely go check it out. I think we need to wrap up. We're coming up on the time here. I love talking to you. I can talk to you for hours. I just hanging out and chatting. We'll do more of that in New York City. When are you going to be there at the conference?
I am going to be there. Going to be there.
So we'll hang out with you then. Let me ask you that our one question that we ask everybody before we wrap up here. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
You know, when you kind of alluded that this question was coming in the beginning, it's kind of been noodling around in the back of my head, and I've been dying to, can I come up with a clever, insightful, like an answer that probably nobody has said before? And truth is I don't have one. The way we do it is, I think this practice of ours, mine, everyone's, it's kind of personality based. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if somebody says, I want to hire an architect to do my house, if their only requirement is to have 5 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms and a dining room and it doesn't leak, line forms to the left. Right. Why would I didn't get that from anybody? Why do they want it from me?
Yeah.
I think being like letting you be you, letting your personality be a big part of the process, and is really important for people to do. And this kind of idea cemented itself actually when I started writing the blog, and it became readily apparent that, you know, you can't be all things to all people at all times and experience any kind of satisfaction or pleasure from the process. So I think learning how to be true to yourself while not being disrespectful or condescending is the one thing that's made the biggest difference when it's come to how we develop client relationships and how we run projects in our office. Because we tell people, you're going to have a lot of fun doing this. You know, a lot of people kind of dread the process a little bit. And with so many products out there that are readily available, I mean, there's no shortage of houses that somebody can go buy today and move into. So right. Why do they want to sign up for, you know, an 18 or 24 month process? And I go, because you're going to have a lot of fun. It's going to change your life. And this is going to be an awesome experience. And that's one of the things that we really promote. And so I think really kind of figuring out who you are and letting yourself be known to the people you're working with is really, a lot of people are scared to do that, I think.
Yeah.
Might go, I'm a jerk, right? But you need to own it. You know, you need to be that person, because somebody's not going to think you're a jerk. They're going to think you're amazing.
Yeah. Authenticity. You be you. My sure. When I was about, I don't know, I was probably about 16, and I have an older brother who's 4 years older than me, and we didn't work out so well as kids. Great, great, great brothers now, but as kids, we had lots of conflicts. And I always looked up to him and always tried to be him, you know? And one day he came to me, he said, you be you, you know, and when he said that, my whole life changed. You know, I stopped trying to be him. I stopped trying to be other things. And it dawned on me later in my life, looking back at that, what that means. It really means what you just said, you be you and go all in on you. And there's a community out there who wants to embrace that. And there may be others who don't, but there's a community for you who wants to embrace that. And so I think that's great advice. Thanks for that.
Yeah. You know, well, I'll tell you, and I know you're wrapping it up, but one of the things that really kind of cemented it for me was when I started writing the blog. And, you know, and of course, everybody's main fear when they're going to put themselves out there in that capacity is looking like an idiot to their peers or their friends or, you know, whatnot. And what I realized is that as much as I felt that I was unique and special and, you know, my path from A to where I'm at right now is like totally my own, it really doesn't deviate much with the thousands of people that have emailed me to say, here's my life story, so that you need to know my entire background before I can ask you this question. They're all incredibly similar. They're all very, very, very similar. And what I realized is there's more value in letting people know that you like to speak Klingon, and you knit on the weekends and you're a fan of cat juggling videos, because you're going to realize that there's a, as shocking as this is, there's a lot of people out there that like those exact same things. But you don't ever realize it because in your little bubble, you know, before social media and digital technology kind of allowed us to connect with anybody all over the place, you really feel kind of isolated. And I don't want to say special, because that makes it sound like we're all princes and princesses. But we all think we're unique. But the truth is whatever you like, other people like it too. It's just a matter of finding those people and finding people that can support you and what you're doing, because that's also what they're into. So part of it's just you being you, but part of it's also putting yourself out there to help find the people that will support you in being you.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. You said you didn't have one, but that that is absolutely a great one. So thanks for sharing that. The website at the architecture firm is mmbarchitects.com. The blog, and most people probably know the blog, it's lifeofanarchitect.com. It's an easy one to find. You could search Bob Borson and you'll find his whole life online. Facebook is Life of an Architect, and then Twitter and Instagram is at Bob Borson. So I highly recommend everybody go check him out there. Go subscribe to his blog, and it's a great read every week. Actually, it's once a week still.
It's normally at least once a week.
Yeah.
Thanks. I've slowed down over the years.
Yeah, I know. You did every day, and then you did every couple of days. Actually, if everybody wants, we talked about the blog on episode 2. So go check out entrearchitect.com/episode 2, I think. I don't think it's 002. I think it's 2, but you can search on the blog and find them. I think that's a great episode too. You'll hear the audio quality and how we've increased and gotten better over the years. So thanks for being there in episode 2. Thanks for being here on this later episode. I appreciate you for being here, and I appreciate what you do for the profession, both inside the profession as well as, you know, outside the profession. So thanks, Mark, for doing that.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me back after 205,000 episodes.
Thanks for being here on Entree Architect Podcast. Well, there you go, my friend Bob Borson, sharing all kinds of things that maybe you didn't hear anywhere else. That was my goal here with this episode, is to not dive deep into blogging like he, you know, that's what everybody asks Bob, because Life of an Architect, the blog, has got a million subscribers, and you know, it's breaks through the charts every day, and everybody wants to talk to him about that. We talked about that in episode 2. I just wanted to talk about Bob and learn more about who Bob was, what makes him tick, talk about his family a little bit, his firm. So I hope you enjoyed it. This is a great episode to share. You know, if you want to, if you know somebody who reads Bob's blog and says, hey, want to know a little bit more about Bob Borson, go check out entrearchitect.com/episode217. That's this episode, entrearchitect.com/episode217. Go share this with a friend. Put it on Facebook. Put it on Twitter. Send an email to a friend. Tap a friend on the shoulder around the corner in the next cubicle and say, hey, Bob Borson's on Entree Architect. Go check it out, entrearchitect.com/episode217. I would appreciate it. Also, if you're not a member of our Entree Architect Facebook group, it's called The Entree Architect Community. It is the most active, most supportive, most encouraging, most positive group on the internet for small firm architects. Come join us. You will be welcome there. If you're an architect or an architectural student, come join us. entrearchitect.com/group. It's a private Facebook group. It's free, but it's private. You have to be an architect or an architectural student to join. Just request a membership. We'll let you in. We just passed 2,600 members inside there. So come hang out with us. If you have a question about anything, you'll get 50, 60, 70, 100 respondents from passionate architects just like you who want to help you. That's what that group's for. So entrearchitect.com/group. Go check that out. Go check out my friends at ArchiSpeak Podcast and Inside the Firm Podcast. Two fantastic podcasts. If you like what I'm doing here at Entree Architect, you're going to love what you hear over there. Go check them out and then tweet them and say, hey, Entree Architect is talking about you over there. So two fantastic podcasts, two that I don't miss every week. So go check them out. And what else do I have for you? I think that's it. I appreciate you for being here. I really do. I encourage you to go share what you know with a friend and another architect. Be transparent, be honest, encourage others to share what they know. I really appreciate you for being here. My name is Mark R. LePage. I am an entrepreneur architect. I am rambling, but I also encourage you to build a better business, because that's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to do this. That's how we're going to change the way the profession runs around here. You make more money, the whole profession benefits from that. So entrearchitect.com, go check that out. Go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.